Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey guys, you're now listening to the Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach, coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy.
All right, guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name is Coach Yas, and I've got a very special guest with me today. My guest today is Adam Belletta. Morning, Adam. How are you doing, man?
I'm good, thank you. Yourself?
Yeah, very well, thank you. I'm really looking forward to this, to be honest. It's been a long time coming. Yeah. Adam, just before we get into the real thick of things, maybe just give a brief insight around who you are, what you do, and we'll go from there.
I'm the 9s to 14s lead at Watford. I've been there for 5 years now. Yeah, so recently the 9s to 14s. So that's my role at the club.
Awesome. And we'll get into that in a little while. But just, you know, take us back to the start of your journey, Adam. You know, obviously we've all come into coaching in different ways, but for a lot of us is, you know, not quite being good enough as a player. So we just naturally transitioned to the coaching. And obviously as time has gone on, we've recognised there's so many different paths we can go down. So what, you know, where did your journey start? And, you know, what was it about coaching in particular that kind of grabbed you?
I don't really know where coaching grabbed me. I kind of just started doing it. So I was part of like one of the first kind of college programs at Stevenage. So before they were kind of in the league and had a scholarship program and an academy. So I was on that program that was based out of North Hertfordshire College in Hitchin. And it was run really professionally. And I was there as an apprentice, as you like. It was like a college scheme, like you see a lot of them nowadays. But it was very much just training all day, every day, bit of college alongside it. There was the opportunity to play like Youth Cup, FA, like reserve team games. I had the opportunity to play, well, be a part of a few reserve team games, which was a great experience, but quickly realised in my first year that I was probably not going to be good enough. For whatever reasons, I knew that. And started to kind of delve a little bit into coaching, started to think about how I could earn money out of football, because football was obviously a passion of mine. And in that first year, I started doing a little bit down the what is now the academy at Stevenage. And it was like tot sessions and things on a Saturday morning that earned me a little bit of money, alongside obviously travelling in. I had to drive in or get a bus in or stuff like that. So I needed to fund that a little bit myself. And then it just went from there, really. It snowballed from there. So in my second year, started doing like the development centre stuff in the evenings, still did the Saturday mornings. Finished my 2 years. Didn't really know what to do next. So just went, well, I did quite well in my BTEC. I'll go uni then. Like a lot of us probably do go, well, that's the next thing. Did football studies. So football studies at the University of Bedfordshire, because I wanted to stay local. I could obviously have gone and moved away and done the whole uni life thing, but I decided, well, no, I've got some coaching opportunities already that at quite a good level, like development centre level, and didn't want to lose out on that by moving away. and then quickly found that uni wasn't for me. I didn't like just being talked at, didn't like the way that you interact with your lecturers and stuff like that. I've quickly found out I didn't like that. So started to have some conversations with people at Stevenage and said, well, I don't think I'm going to go after year one. I don't think I'll continue. Wanted to get year one in out the way so that if I wanted to go back or if over the summer I changed my mind, I had that option available to me. And then that summer, they said, oh, on the college program that I'd just left, there's an opportunity to go in as an assistant coach, which was like, well, you do the warm-ups, you do some technical work, stuff like that. You'd just be basically around every day doing bits of work. I went, yeah, fine, that's for me. That's a great start for me. And that was with, it was the company that ran it for Stevenage was called ABC Sports. And that had some really good people on it. Robbie O'Keefe, Darren Sahl, Dave Reddington, that obviously was recently at Palace as the first team coach and is now, I think, in Norway or Denmark. So some really good people to work alongside. But then one of the guys actually left. So a guy called Craig Rideheard left. And they went, well, there's an option if you want to, you can assist. But then you can also lead like the third group. So I went, all right. So I'm a level two coach. I'm about a year and a half older than some of the boys on the program. And just had to kind of jump into it. So every day I was like leading on a group that obviously weren't the best, but wanted to be part of a college program, wanted to be in education and do football, which was great. And then was assisting on obviously the elite boys, the really good boys, and working under Darren and Redders to kind of with the best players. So that was kind of a big jump in quite a quick time. So yeah, we did that for three or four seasons. And in that time, after about a year, I got involved with Luton, doing, again, first of all, I think it was called TIPS. So basically just a talent ID in the community type thing, which at the time Greg Broughton was running. So Greg wasn't the academy manager then. And he was running the development centres. Greg then went into the academy. I followed suit, started working in the academy. So again, at 19, 20, I'm working with some really good players whilst doing the college programme. So my whole day is coaching, which is great. I'm leaving the college programme, travelling over to Luton, doing the academy boys. So I did that. And then Luton wanted to set up an elite under 18 group. So they wanted to have boys that supplemented the scholars. It probably still happens. It still happens where I work now. The 18s get taken by the 21s, the 21s get taken by the first team, and then that 18s group ends up with five players. So they wanted to kind of negate that a little bit by having an elite group that was maybe late developers physically or boys that they weren't quite sure on and wanted to give a bit more time. Boys that had maybe come out of other academies and hadn't been offered a scholarship and wanted to come onto this pathway. So I helped them set that up and went full-time at Luton, which again was great. I was in one place all the time, working with good players, 16 to 18, supplementing the scholarship program. And it was a really, really good time because we had one group of like 18 players who were all of a very good level. And that group of players did very, very well for themselves. There's a few boys that are kind of now playing professionally. One at Stevenage, Kane Smith, Will Wright at Gillingham, and a number of other boys that are playing like good levels of non-league now as well. So it was a really good time. I spent 8 years at Luton. And then Luton's a really good club and everyone just stays there forever. So in terms of my own progression, started to get a little bit restless. I wanted to be like the one of the leads of a cohort, whether it's 9s to 11s or whatever. I wanted to have that. And those opportunities weren't really going to be coming up at Luton at that time because of everyone just enjoyed working at the club. It was a good club to work for. So I decided to go back to Stevenage. The position came up at Stevenage to be the foundation phase lead. So I went back there and spent the best part of three seasons there. And then a 13s, 14s lead role, or 12s to 14s, I think, came up at Watford. Said, right, well, that's the next step, bigger jump. better, well, what you perceive as a better academy. So obviously playing that they were in the Premier League at the time, went into Watford, got the job at Watford. And then I've been there now for nearly 5 years. And my role has changed there a few times since I've been there. I've been the 12s to 14s lead. I was in the 9s and 10s lead. Then I was 9s to 12s. And then now more recently, 9s to 14s. So that's been my journey. It's all really been, I've not really had any experiences of grassroots football. I've delved a little bit into men's football. I did a season at Hitchin Town in the Evo Stick Prem, which I loved, but just couldn't fit in with all the academy stuff that I was doing at Luton at the time. Just didn't quite kind of marry up well enough. So I only did a season of that. But again, I thoroughly enjoyed working in the men's game as well and having that competitive element where it's all about gearing up for 3 points. So yeah, I've had a only really in like elite football. I've not really had much in, well, I've had no experiences in really in grassroots football. So my only kind of experience with that would be helping one of my mates when he was setting up the kind of development centres, you know, at this time of year where they need free school meals. I did some stuff with that. And then you go, well, this is real coaching because you've got a kid that's very good. And then you've got a kid that can barely kick it. And he's just there because he likes football or mum and dad want some support in looking after him or her. And that for me was like, wow, that's a big culture shock, like having to deal with a good player and a very average player and how you keep them both engaged. So I've been very fortunate to maybe not, well, fortunate in one way, I suppose, that I've only worked with elite players. And I suppose unfortunate in other ways.
Yeah, no, look, Adam, first of all, thank you for that. There's so much in there to unpack. And, you know, see, right at the top of it, I said, you know, about everyone having a different journey in terms of how they come into it and how they've progressed and where they've got to now. And I think, you know, that's, you know, again, even more evident with yourself, not necessarily having to go through that quote unquote grassroots kind of experience to get to where you have. So, you know, I want to take you right back to the start of that. Obviously, you talked there about your first experiences really about coaching players in and around your age. Now, that comes with its own challenges. I've been there myself. You know, there is probably some benefits to it, but there's probably a lot of challenges that we probably don't recognise and appreciate till further down the line. And, you know, with that being your first experience, you know, probably very different to someone who maybe has had some experience and then going into that. You know, some of us start out at 16 and you might have 2 years under you, but before you go into a programme like that, if you like. So what was that like for you? What was it? You know, obviously you mentioned there a lot of it was really much assisting the programme. In the delivery and obviously then leading on kind of one of the secondary groups, if you like. What was that like for you? You know, you get your first kind of, you know, experiences, you get your teeth stuck in there.
It was brilliant. Like I say, it was a mixed week every week because that group that I had as like the lead coach, they were playing in a league that was probably too difficult for them. So I think we went 6 months without a point. And that was difficult for myself because I hadn't experienced that before. And how do you keep the boys motivated? And it was just, we had to get them just working harder than other teams, get them fitter than other teams, improve them obviously technically as much as we could each week and each day, get them better tactically and trying to concede less goals and give ourselves a chance. And when that first win came, I can still remember it now, and it's over 10 years ago. I remember it was almost like a team winning an FA Cup. It was like the boys went mental, and it was brilliant. And that was probably the most resilient I've ever had to be, I think, in terms of my football journey. That was, how do you keep the buy-in? How do you keep them believing in what you're coaching them? Because what you're coaching them isn't getting them a win, isn't getting them even a point. And we would, like I said, I was very lucky. I had he's still my best mate. I had a guy, Ian Lewis, who is the head of coaching at Stevenage. He's still there. And we just worked together on it. And it was, we had to pick each other up every day. And Ian at the time was a pro. He was a pro at Stevenage and he was just doing it. He just finished playing professionally there. And he was a very good footballer. So he would join in as much and he would be the guy that drove like the intensity and the tempo and together we were like good cop, bad cop. And that's how we got buy-in. So yeah, that was challenging. And then obviously I was learning my trade from Darren and from Redders every day by assisting them and going, well, what are they doing? How do they interact with the boys? What sessions are they putting on? And then just unpacking it with them. Go, well, why have you delivered it that way? Why have you put that session on? Because back then you'd have a brief syllabus, but it was more, right, well, identify what the boys need and go from there. And it's like, well, they need so much. Where do you start? Like with the group that I'm leading, it's like they need so much. So what's your starting point? And yeah, it was that was probably the most difficult time. But I look back on it now, it's probably some of my fondest times, just because of the great people I was working with and the amount of time they spent with me, helping me as well. They would come out and watch me and go, well, that wasn't good enough, or that was really good. And that the way you coached that bit was excellent. And you were getting what, like your old school, like level twos, level threes, where you're getting assessed every day on your session and going, well, that wouldn't be a pass. That it was like, well, that's not good enough. That's not what we want. And without it being detrimental to my own learning, it was excellent. Constantly on your toes, having to plan and prepare and think. And like, yeah, I look back on it with fun times.
Talk about, you know, having a tough experience to start out with, you know, probably put you in good stead in terms of going forward, in terms of how you again interact with your players, and I guess dealing with the impact of that. Because I guess, you know, for a young coach, at some point she probably felt, oh, is this my fault?
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? And which is also a challenge as well, because a lot of coaches, you know, if we're being honest, when players don't quite get it right or they're not getting what they want out of it, sometimes the coaches can often blame the players. But actually, you know, one thing that's kind of worked really well for me over the years in terms of holding my standards up to a high level is if the players are doing it well, it's because of them. And if it's not going right, it's because of me. And, you know, I've always kind of taken that approach, and it's done me really well, because I'm constantly stretching and challenging myself around how I can further develop it and make things even better for them. But, you know, again, there's so much in what you mentioned there in that. Let's talk about, you know, coaching relationships for a second. You know, you talked there about you and I and working together and having a good cop, bad cop. I'm going to go ahead and assume that you were the bad cop.
Yeah, no, to be fair, it was a bit of both. I think he had a bigger bark than me at times in terms of, yeah, he had just a better bark than I did at times for different things. We would almost plan it because we needed to, and we'd have to make sure, because the way we felt at the time is like, well, if we've got to make sure it's planned, because we've probably not got enough experience of it at that time. We've obviously had been on the end of it and the receiving end of it. But then it was making sure that we had things planned and go, right, well, this is how we're going to approach it. And yeah, it worked out. It worked in our favor in the end. But it was a bit of both. It wasn't just one person every time.
Yes, I mean, because that's quite interesting, because obviously, you know, one of the biggest challenges, well, let's just talk typically, you know, a lot of the coaches I've come across, and, you know, especially through my coach development journey as well, and even my own journey, you know, we often start out in situations where we're coaching alone a lot of the time, and we don't really have the other person to kind of bounce off in some cases, and, you know, unless we're really deliberate and intentional, kind of informed, we often don't work in collaboration. You work together because you're there together, but actually, you know, what you often see is one coach leads and the other coach just waits for their turn, basically. You know, I mean, it's kind of, right, when do I get my turn? But, you know, that piece around collaboration and co-coaching, if you like, is actually really important. So you know, just talk to us a little bit about that, around how you found that and what kind of conversations were taking place, if at all any, around how that would look. Because one of the biggest things I say to coaches now, that in fact probably one of the most challenging skills to develop, is that ability to co-coach, where in some ways it requires you to almost take your ego out of it and recognize that there is a group of players in front of you, and it's not about you or the other coach, it's about how you can get the most out of each other to get the best out of the players, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think as I look back on it now, me and Jan were actually about, we were due before Christmas to do some like collaborative CPD with our two clubs around co-coaching, actually, because we thought back on it and went, we were doing it miles before it kind of became the option, because now you go into academy football, you do get the luxury of having somebody to work with, whether it's an assistant coach, whether it's you both just working together. But as you said before, it's like you get, well, I'm doing the warm up, so I'll lead that and you just sit back and watch. It's how we want it to be, is how we used to have it, is that, well, if I'm doing that, you're doing the other half of it. So if I'm doing attacking, you're making it harder for me by getting the defenders doing things better. Or if I'm doing the group stuff, you can touch on some individuals. Or you're making sure the intensity is still there while I'm pulling a player out and coaching him. You're making sure that the session doesn't dip and the standards are still there, because I think that's what can naturally happen, is that, and it happens a lot when you're on your own. You want to pull a player, but you know that part, that while you're pulling that one player, little Johnny, the other 10, 11, 12, however many are playing the 6v6, 7v7, 8v8, whatever you're playing, you know that unless you're on top of them at times, or you know that you've got those standards instilled in them where you know for 30 seconds, a minute, it might be all right. That's what your co-coach is for. I don't really like looking at it as a lead coach and an assistant coach. It's just your two coaches. And I don't want anyone to feel like, well, he's leading, so I'm not involved, or she's not involved, or whatever. So yeah, in those conversations that me and Yian had, it was more just around, like you said, it was going, well, what do the boys need? Who needs what? How are we going to get the best out of that? Well, I'll do that bit. You make sure you're doing this bit. And we just constantly, because we were best friends, it was easy. Because we had a really good relationship away from work as well. So we were constantly talking about what we're going to do tomorrow. We had that luxury because we were inseparable, really, because we were at work together. We went to the gym together. We went out together. We went for food together. It was constantly talking. So I know you don't get that luxury in your workplace now. But the conversations were just so informal that by the next morning we go, well, we know what we're doing.
I think it's a great point. You know, you talk there about, you know, not really the idea of lead and assistant coaches, and I think it's a great point, because, you know, I often say to coaches, well, if you want to look at it as lead, in fact, you both lead, but you just lead on different parts. And it shouldn't be like a hierarchical kind of approach to it, in the sense of, right, this person might be the director, if you like, but actually we've all got a role to play.
Yeah.
And it's just identifying clearly what that looks like. So, you know, another thing that you mentioned obviously is the fact that you went through a period of almost 6 months without getting any points. You know, let's talk about that a little bit. You know, how do you keep those players engaged? And yeah, and then linking it back to another thing that you mentioned around, you know, these holiday type camps where you're working with players, you said this is where real coaching comes in. Just tell us a little bit more about that.
So the period where we didn't go get a point was difficult, like I say, mentally for I think everybody. But we had good support in Sali, going, we'll just keep plugging away, keep believing in what you're believing in. And eventually something will happen. And I remember it when we got that win. He was the first person that picked up the phone. It was like 11 o'clock at night. And he went, how does that feel? And we were buzzing. Me and Jan were buzzing, because it was like we'd won the game, I think maybe 1-0. But it was like, and it weren't even a great goal. It was a bit of a dodgy goal, I think. And we were like, we'll take it. but during that, like I say, we just had good support around us and went, well, let's keep plugging away. Let's keep making them better at how they defend as a unit. And just being fitter and harder working than other teams, being just a bit ugly, I suppose, is the best word. And just making games difficult. And I think if you look at academy football, that ugliness goes at times. You go, well, oh, we're just not good enough at building. Well, how do you earn the right to build or play through or play round and over? Sometimes you have to just match teams physically, or be better than them physically, or work harder, or make the game a little bit scrappier to break their momentum and their tempo, and then that gives you an opportunity to get a foothold in the game. And I think that's probably what that period of time taught me was that's what we have to get done. You just have to match them physically or outwork them, and think good things will come from that. And eventually it did. So that was that kind of time. And like I say, just the support network around me as an individual and me as a coach at that time was brilliant. And then, yeah, when I say about proper coaching, I just think I've been very fortunate that the gap that I have between the best player and the worst player is minimal. And on another day, that role can flip. The one that was the worst on Monday might be the best on Tuesday. And trying to differentiate is a lot easier because the differences in technical ability, game understanding is the I suppose the biggest problem I get is, well, I've got in the 14s, I've got a lad that's 6'3" and I've got a lad that's 5'1". And that's probably my biggest challenge. Well, how do I make sure that they're both getting what they need? Because matching them up, there's going to be some trade-offs, but is it beneficial for them at that time and planning that? But yeah, having to go in and go, well, how do I keep that really good player engaged in this game that we're doing without going, well, this is too hard, and having that challenge point that is correct for both players, and how he might have some extra individual challenges because he's the best player in that little group. And he's just maybe picked up the first part of the game and the practice that we're doing and realises it's from A to B to C to D and then he moves or whatever. That was my first experience. And that probably only happened 3 or 4 years ago, where you're going in and I'm going, wow, what is this? So obviously you see it when you play grassroots teams, because we do play grassroots teams in academy football, and you see the difference in levels. But then when you have to coach it, it's challenging. And fair play to those coaches that are doing it for either because their kids playing in it, or that's their start of their journey, or it's their private business. It's difficult, and I take my hats off to them because it's not an easy challenge.
100%. And let's talk about that a little bit more, because you're quite right. You know, the challenge in terms of the variations that you might come across in terms of players might be much more, let's just say, vast in grassroots football as opposed to academy football, where you'd like to think everyone is kind of on a similar playing field. Obviously, they're all going to have their individual differences and strengths and areas for development, but they're largely at a certain level. What would your thoughts be on the idea that maybe because of that reason, that some of the coaches are a bit too relaxed, or maybe not as effective or impactful as they maybe should or could be in academy football? Because that's the challenge as well. Coaches can sometimes think, oh yeah, the players are good enough, I'm just going to put them through some practices. And from my experience and my observations over the years, I often look at some of our people, well, when are you actually going to coach the kids? Yes, we get that they're good. That's why they're in the building. But how do we get them to become even better without just running through practices, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think there's the niche at the minute, isn't it, going of having a very player-led approach. And I think that's a skill to have player-led, but without it just being you have facilitated something. Right, there's the game, go play. And then actually you just step back and all you're doing is making sure that nobody's getting injured and you're refereeing the game. I think that's the real skill of the coach, is going, well, yes, I'm going to do some player-led stuff, but I know when to step in. I know when I'm not getting the right returns from it. So in terms of that, I think that's the niche at the moment, is having a very player-led approach. And unless you've had lots of experience of it, I think that's what happens, is you just facilitate and it looks nice to the naked eye and it looks nice to maybe the parents. But then I don't think you're maximising returns. Of course, if the kids are playing football, if you just put on a game, they're learning something, they're getting better at something, but you probably haven't maximised that opportunity at that time. And obviously in academy football and any level of coaching, you've only got them for so long. And you've only got so much time to get them to the next level, especially in academy football. So every moment is key. And obviously, there are elements of the week where I go, actually, I just want them to play because they're kids, especially with the 9s to kind of 12s. I do want them to have that element of going, well, right, for 20 minutes, half an hour, that session is planned. Just let them play. Make sure the intensity is right. Make sure they're trying to do the things that we want them to do in terms of the philosophy that we have. Don't let it just become a free-for-all. But just let them play. And sometimes you see some of the best stuff come out of the individuals, because they'll show you something that they've not shown you before. They'll try something that they've not tried before, because you're not always going, don't do that, or do it this way, or try that. So Yeah, that's my take on it. Hopefully I've answered your question.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm glad you mentioned the point around player led, because it's been a topic of debate with a few different people I've spoken to recently. And, you know, I guess a few observations is around everyone saying they want to be player led. But I think people sometimes get misguided and misunderstood the differences between player led and player centred. You know, player led is great, you know, within reason. But ultimately, is it player-centred? I think we can fall into a trap a little bit where, like you said, we're not maximising our time with the players and having the best impact possible. And just because something's working well or something's working okay doesn't mean it's working the best, if that makes sense. And, you know, what would your thoughts be on the idea that, you know, everyone's banging on about player-led, but actually once they get to 15, 16, kind of goes out the window?
Yeah, I think 15, 16, you're probably trying to teach them what they need to know. It becomes a bit more, right, these are maybe your shortcomings, or this is what you're really good at, do lots more of that. This is what you're not quite good enough at yet, you need to get better at that. I think from what I've seen I've been at a couple of academies, and I still get to go and watch other academies work. There is some really good work being done around player-led stuff with those older age groups, around maybe it's their individual learning plans, whether it's the conversations that they're having in that social corner, them being able to lead on, whether it's analysis. I know that the 15, 16s guys at the place I'm at, they do some really good stuff with the players unpacking their game and their match analysis, and going have those conversations with each other, because that's difficult now. I think kids of this generation are very much, well, don't dig me out about that.
Too busy on TikTok.
They're not comfortable with it. And it's not a personal dig. It's going, that's what happened. You were at fault for the goal. Just make sure next time you're a bit more switched on from that set piece or whatever. And our boys have got really good at it. And we're starting to do some stuff with the 9s to 12s around how they perceive our playing philosophy, and then getting comfortable in delivering back to one, their parents, so their parents understand what we're working on, but also then sending that into us so that we can see what their understanding of the build is, the create, the finish, and going, well, no, you're miles, some of the boys are miles off what we think they know, and when they're delivering it back, you go, yeah, you don't know what we're on about, and that's good for us because we know where they're at and what their understanding is. So yeah, still, like I say, going back to those older players not being able to have player-led stuff, I think if you've got good coaches and experienced coaches and ones that are mindful, then I think it can still happen. I'm not a massive fan of that player-led stuff all the time, just because I think it can have that not lots going on. And I like sessions to be messy. If a session's, for me, in my opinion, if everything's going smoothly and there's lots of success, again, I talk about challenge point a lot. The challenge point's probably not high enough. So they've mastered they've understood what you've taught them. They've understood the challenge. They've got there. Loads of success, great. Well, what's the next challenge point?
Yeah. It's always just keeping them just outside that, you know, that zone, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it needs to be hard enough where they're engaged. Yeah. And that's where, like I say, you can add that, again, that can be the differentiation in the players, is that for one kid, a challenge could be too hard and he gets demotivated. But another kid, he likes that tough challenge. Yeah. And he might be, I suppose, what people would perceive maybe as old school. He loves something that's too hard and goes, well, I'm going to get there. Yeah. Whereas maybe a lot of kids in the current generation are going, I want to get there the quickest way.
Do you think there's enough support for the kids to go, you know, we talked there about the player-led approach and, you know, progressing through the age groups. But there's enough kid support for the players generally in supporting them with that transition from kind of a player-led approach to more a coach-led approach? Because I feel like I've seen a lot of the observations I've made around that is you get to about under 14 and it's kind of very much, yeah, we're going to go player-led, but then it's almost like, boom, cut it out.
Yeah. No, I think there has to be they have to have a variety. They can't just have, for example, the Q&A all the time, and then all of a sudden a bit of command comes in. They've got to have, you've got to have all of that. So myself as a coach, I would say when I first started coaching.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Was very command, because the group of players I was working with, I went, they ain't good enough. You need to do this. This is what's going to get you there. As you become maybe a better coach, or you work with better players, you can go, well, I can start delving into more Q&A or some more guide and discovery. But you can't just go, well, I'm only going to be a Q&A coach. I think you've got to be able to do all of them. There'll be ones that you're not very comfortable with. Some coaches won't be, they're not comfortable with going, do that. They want to be the coach that goes, well, have you thought about this? I think that's probably what's happening now, is that command style is very, I don't see it very often, unless you, like you say, you get to the older age groups, you see quite a lot more of command, do this, that isn't quite good enough, etc., etc. And I think the boys need that, because, like you say, otherwise when they get to the age group where that comes in, they go, what's this? I've never heard that before. Yeah. And then they rebel, or, well, I'm not going to play for him, or they sulk or whatever. So they need to have it.
Do you think that it's almost a generational thing in terms of the coaches as well? Because obviously a lot of the coaches who typically, if you like, your typical command style coach is probably somebody who's a lot more experienced, probably somebody who's maybe gone through an older pathway of coach education, if you like, you know. Yeah. And obviously that's changed massively over the last kind of 10 or 12 years, where it is much more around this player-led approach. And I think the challenge for coaches obviously is recognizing what type of interventions to use, when to use them, and who to use them with, the why behind that as well, but also recognizing that if you're going to use the Q&A approach or whatever approach you're going to use it in an effective manner. So, you know, I've seen so many times where coaches will ask players questions, but they're always closed questions. So what are you really learning from that? And, you know, you made a point there about getting the players to kind of relay to you through analysis and through reflections around what their understanding is of what's expected of them as part of the club philosophy or whatever else that may be. And maybe not trusting the players enough to give them an answer that's genuine to them and authentic to them, and more utilizing the closed questions, if you like, to kind of manage the conversation and direct it in a way where the coaches can almost satisfy their egos to say, yeah, they're on point with what I wanted to see. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You see it all the time, don't you? You get the under, I don't know, under 10s or 11s, and they'll all put their hand up and they just blurt the answers that they think you want to hear. Or they'll go, one kid will say that, and then that's, and you end up just getting there eventually because they all just blurt out things that they know. And like I said, I think it's very, you have to be very skilled in your Q&A, like you say, to go, well, make sure, one, that it's an open question, because if it's not an open question, you might as well have just gone command and gone, that's how I want it done. But you have to be very skillful, and make sure that you can confuse the kid, because if he answers it wrong two or three times, well, he doesn't know the answer, so you need to tell him. Or you need to guide him towards finding the answer. Well, I don't know, go and ask, what do you think? Do you think, which teammate do you think might know the answer to that? Or who do you think does that really well? Ask him how he solves that problem. So, yeah, I think Q&A is probably one of the easiest, because you can get them to a point by just keep asking questions, or no, you don't know the answer. And then coaches are quickly enough, will give them the answer. Well, then again, why have you asked the question if they don't know the answer? Don't give them it unless they really need to know it at that point. Be happy and be comfortable and go, well, they don't know the answer yet. Let's see if I can help them get there by the end of the session.
100%. Also, you know, that piece around asking the question and giving them time to actually answer. You know, the amount of time I see coaches ask a question, and if they don't hear a response within 2-3 seconds, they just anticipate and assume, oh, the players don't know it, so I'm just going to fill the gap. It's like, I think it's almost part of the skill of asking those questions is having the patience just to let the question, you know, fester for a second.
Yeah.
Let them
it's
think.
It's uncomfortable, isn't it? Silence is uncomfortable. Yeah. And you have to be comfortable being uncomfortable.
but in some ways, it's probably one of the, if you like, most impactful coaching behaviors, is to allow that silence.
Yeah.
You know, and get people thinking, you know, in those uncomfortable moments, really get them thinking and get them to challenge themselves around, what is the coach asking of me here? And even for, it's even an opportunity for the coach then to reflect, was that question the right question? So I think there's so much in there. But, you know, let's unpack your journey further. Obviously, you mentioned that, you know, you're at Watford at present. What are the biggest changes that you saw, obviously, going from Stevenage to Watford? Obviously, going foundation phase lead at Stevenage, foundation phase lead to start off with, obviously, at Watford. What, you know, what were the massive differences there? Was it what you was expecting? And, you know, what did you feel that Stevenage did really well that you wanted to bring with you to Watford?
First of all, both, I have to say both in the times that I was there, I thought, when I was at Stevenage, I thought the programme was very, very good. And where I'm at now, I think it is very, very good. In terms of the differences, obviously you're going Cat 3 to Cat 2. So facilities straight away, you're going, well, within a year, I was working in a dome. I've got a dome all the time now, and the luxury of it being heated. So it's not one of those cold domes where you're freezing all the time and you have to wear hat, gloves, snood, everything. It's a nice environment for the boys to work in. So straight away facilities, but also just the opportunities that we can give the boys in terms of the games programme. The games programme is obviously a little bit better, in my opinion, from Cat 3 to Cat 2 because of the clubs you get access to. Obviously, at the time when I went in Watford, we were in the Premier League, so you get access to the Premier League games programme as well, so the festivals and playing the Cat ones a bit more regularly, which when I was at Stevenage, it was, it's through your connections. It's like, who do you know? Right, you're playing, they might be playing, I don't know, Brighton, and then Brighton are only taking one group. Well, we'll come and bring a team up, wherever it is. We'll bring an extra one, so you've got 2 7v7s going or whatever. So that was probably the biggest challenges at Stevenage, was getting the games programme to a point where you weren't playing teams 3 times a year. So I remember going in and you'd have your local ones all 3 times a year. You'd play Luton 3 times a year. You'd play MK Dons 3 times a year. You'd play Southend 3 times a year. You go, well, instead of playing them 3 times, well, let's play them twice. And in those extra ones, let's try and play a Cat 1 or a Cat 2 and improve the games programme. So they're probably the first two things, just resources, games programme, facilities. They're the biggest changes. There's good people at both places. Obviously, the staffing levels that we have now are through the roof. We've got 2 coaches with every age group, which is brilliant from a player perspective. Whereas when I was at Stevenage, it was like, well, you've got a lead coach and you might have a volunteer. And that volunteer is sometimes he's there or she's there. And sometimes they're working. And you go, well, I can't really argue that you're working, you're doing this for free. I thank you for your time, but that's pretty much all you can do. So, and there were some limitations there. We obviously always on like power league courts. So for the older age groups, as much as it was good for like intensity and being really good in some tight spaces, then when you saw them go 11v11, you went, well, they can't open the pitch up. They can't switch play effectively enough because they don't practice that range of pass often enough. So that was something that in the time I was there and we were there, the people that were there at the time, we had to improve that. Whereas where I am now, we've got a dome that is 110 yards by 75 yards. They're playing in realistic sized areas most of the time. Of course, they've got nights where we share the dome with other teams and you may be a bit tighter, but we've got a good variety in the areas that we can use. What was the second part to your question? Sorry, I know that was kind of the differences between the two. And
what were some of the key things that you obviously...
I took with me, wasn't it? Yeah. But I was having a conversation with I met up with some of my old colleagues from Stevenage yesterday, actually. And we were talking about why at that time we felt that the academy was successful. And that was because we had a clear vision of the way that we wanted the boys to play. We had some really good people there that were always trying to make the place better, never happy with where it was at and wanting to be and have that. I suppose when I first went in, it was like, they'd probably just got to a point where they were recruiting players that they wanted, rather than going, well, we'll have boys that were released from X, Y, and Z, because obviously they were quite a new academy. I think when I went in, maybe the academy had been in existence 4 or 5 years. So you're always inheriting players that maybe have been released from other clubs or are the best in the area but aren't quite at academy standard. And our challenge was that, and our goal was, right, well, we want to be one of the best Cat 3s in the area. And I'd like to think in that time, with the people that we had running it in Sally and Robbie, that we got there. And we started to produce footballers. Players were getting in the first team, players were getting opportunities, players were going out on loan and doing well, players were getting sold to bigger clubs. And it was a really good time. So that was down to the leadership that we had at the time going, well, this is our direction. Everyone bought into it. Everyone believed in it. Because I think at that time, we'd all played in that system. We'd all played for that person. So, and we'd believed in it because we'd seen how good it could be. So under Sally, we'd all played for him. So I'd played for him. Steve had played for him. Jan had played for him. Tom Hart had played for him. So everyone had played for him and believed in his way. And we were able to coach it. And it saw success at that time. And in terms of what I took over, it was around just bringing in a bit more resilience into the boys, having standards that were kind of high and challenging the boys to get there. And having a direction that you believe in. That's probably what I've taken with me.
I think it's really important, obviously, because, you know, it's clearly you had a picture exactly of what you wanted to go out there and deliver. And obviously, you mentioned a point earlier about when you first started with the college group, it was almost, well, where do I start? What's the foundational stages that what's the first things I need to really cover with these players? You know, and that's a challenge, obviously, that a lot of players, so a lot of coaches do have, not just at the start of their journeys, but even as they go through, in terms of, right, where do I start? So, you know, what would your advice be to coaches who are looking at that? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like in that moment, it was quite a reactionary approach in terms of, right, this is what I've observed in games as an example. So this is what I'm going to do the following session as an example. You know, was that the case? And, you know, if so, how was that?
It was more, we tried to think about where are their shortcomings individually and collectively or in units. So yes, there would be some reactive stuff around, well, in games. I don't know, we might have been playing a 4-3-3, whatever formation we were playing at the time, going, well, that's where we keep getting beat. Or that's the problem we keep having, or that's where it keeps breaking down. So yeah, there would be some work around that and the team element, but a lot of it was, right, what do they need individually or within their unit? So we used to do a lot of stuff where we'd break off into unit stuff and go, right, well, the back four need this work, sliding, stepping together, one steps out, the other shuffle around and close the door, but that kind of stuff. So there was that unit work, but there was everything. It was everything. It was individual, it was unit, it was team. I won't lie, there was some reactive stuff around games. But again, on that college program, we had an identity that we had the elite group, and that was the kind of picture of what we wanted, that they were playing the way we wanted them to play. And it was like, well, how close to that can we get them? So still, we had an idea of how we wanted our teams to play. Because if a boy was going to step from group three to group two, it was the same. It's no different to the academy, I guess.
Just to go back now, your approach still be the same, knowing what you know now? Would there be some different considerations put into it? Because one of the kind of challenges for coaches a lot of the time is, right, we're going to have a syllabus, we're going to have a curriculum of some sort, but actually, how do we decide on where in that curriculum? First of all, what's in the curriculum? What's in the syllabus? And yeah. Second of all, how do we then decide what part of that should go first and last and wherever else it may fit? So, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, curriculums are tough, aren't they? Because every coach, if you're skilled enough, can see let's say it's build. Well, they're really good at that. We probably don't need that at this point in time. Or individually, they don't need that. But that's the syllabus. So our one
at present is very, very open. It might be build, but it's your interpretation of what the players need. And that's what gives us our freedom. Because obviously in the build, there's loads of stuff. It could involve the goalie. It could involve just the fullback. It could involve how we get some rotation in midfield to get the ball into that middle third of the pitch. So I think having that flexibility in your syllabus is what's key. And having some opportunities where you can go off canvas, if you like, and having review weeks or weeks where you go, actually, there's nothing planned. As coaches, what do the boys need? Or what do the players need? And that might be your opportunity to do some unit stuff. It might be it's team stuff. But yeah, we are now. It's a lot of it still. We have over an hour's worth of our individual work every week. And that's obviously in small groups. But they're getting loads of individual work because in academy football, it's all about the individuals. Your teams won't follow through. It's very rare that you'll get a team of 16 players and in 4 years' time, all 16 are still there. It just doesn't happen very often. So we're always trying to think about how do we get the individuals working to their best potential. But I think syllabuses are tough because you want to be out. At some weeks, you just want to go, no, stuff the syllabus. We need to do that because we've seen that for the last 4 or 5 weeks that they're struggling with that, or technically they're struggling with this.
It's one of those ones where you've got your syllabus, you can have your themes, your topics, and your areas. And I think we've got a really key point that you've made there as well is allowing the coaches have an element of freedom and flexibility to interpret theme or the topic, if you like. In a way that they have observed relevance to the team, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I think the other key piece, obviously, you know, having those themes obviously gives you some structure, gives you some guidance around that. But
yeah, it's a framework, isn't it? It's just a start point for that week.
100%. But I think also within that, it's also recognizing that benefits of the syllabus is obviously that you try and cover a little bit of everything. Whereas if you go with a reactionary approach, some things just might never get covered. And just because some things are going well, even with a reactionary approach, you can still interpret that in a different way and say, right, okay, this is where we're going really well, but let's try and crank it up a notch and let's try and get it to the next level, if that makes sense. And I think what the syllabus allows you to do is, like you said, has that framework. But I think where I found it to work best is almost right. Well, here's our framework. What's most relevant for the players this week? As long as we've made a commitment that actually throughout the course of the season or this block of work, we're going to cover all the relevant themes within the syllabus, if that makes sense. And not necessarily in a specific order, but we'll prioritise those themes and those topics in relation to what we are seeing. So it's almost pre-planned, almost semi-reactionary as well.
Yeah, we use our review weeks to do that in terms of, and when we're doing, I don't know, let's say, for example, there was a period of time where, especially in the 7v7 stuff, teams would press with a three, so our build was difficult at times because we played with a back two and a goalie, so it's almost like you're straight into a 3v3 scenario. Well, how do we, and we saw problems over like that block of work for the last 4 or 5 weeks every time teams pressed with a three, because obviously when you're reactionary, the team that you played last week, you're probably not playing again this coming week, so you may not have the same problem. So when we're reviewing what we're going to do in those review weeks is, right, well, what problems are we seeing against, I don't know, we might have had Fulham, then Arsenal, then Tottenham, then whoever. Have we seen similar problems? Right, well, that's probably what we need to work, because if we're seeing against four different teams, probably that's where we need to work. So, and again, that's the skill that the coaches have to have with the ones that I'm working with and myself, is going, well, what are we seeing going wrong? And use those review weeks. We have two review weeks. Use those review weeks to go, right, these are the problems that we've seen. This is how we think you can overcome it. And it, again, it's still linking to our syllabus, but it just gives us a bit of freedom to be, like you say, a little bit reactionary, because you need that sometimes. If your problem doesn't come up for 12 weeks in the syllabus because you've got to wait for it to come back round again, well, at what point do you help them solve the problem? So that's where I think we've got our syllabus in a good place.
Had a range of different roles at Watford, is kind of worked right across the spectrum a little bit now, where it's let's talk about that a little bit. You know, you're talking in terms of some of the key difference. Obviously, I think it's a challenge of it because I think you need the skills regardless of what level of the game you're working at, regardless of what age group you're working at. But what do you think are the most prevalent skills that you maybe require at the foundation phase as opposed to that YDP phase?
I think the skills that I like to see in coaches are that area and working with the kids is they keep it fun. They're not afraid to make a fool of themselves at times. They can keep the kids engaged. They build really good relationships. They keep the kids in love with the game because if they're going to stay in the academy system for however long they're going to stay in, if they're going to stay in at nine all the way through to potentially having it as a career, because obviously at nine to 16, it's not, you shouldn't be perceiving it as, oh, I'm going to be a footballer. It's, you're just in a really good place learning football. And I've always liked that way that Jamie Carragher kind of interpreted it, going, I see it as my son's getting free private education. And that's the way I like to see, I think, academy football should be seen, is that you're getting some of the best coaching around. It won't always be the best because there'll always be someone that's maybe not in academy football that's a really good coach. But you're getting some of the best coaching around and the best opportunities to play against some of the best players. So it probably gives you a really good opportunity to potentially have that as a career. So the things that I like to see, so, and like I say, it's a long, long journey. If you're lucky enough and you make a debut at 19, but a nine-year-old's got a 10-year journey before he potentially makes a debut. And if it gets too serious too soon, I think some kids will lose that love, and I want them to stay in love with football. So the ones that work in the foundation phase have to keep it fun, but also have to be able to guide them and help them develop. And then obviously YDP, you're looking for that greater knowledge of going, well, how they've obviously got a lot of skills already. Can you identify the ones that they're lacking? Can you get them to the next level? And they may need a little bit more experience or a little bit more expertise or have a really good tactical understanding to get the boys to the next level. Whereas obviously in the foundation phase, it's heavily technical, ball mastery, 1v1 dominance, and a little bit of tactical. You don't need to have a great 11v11 understanding because they're not going to play it. But as long as you can understand the game a little bit, you'll be fine. So yeah, that's what I like to see in the coaches, is that as the older they get, it's the finer details and getting them to the next, those smaller margins. Obviously when you're working with nines, they need to learn so much that just drip feed little bits and bobs in and don't overcomplicate it. Don't make it too professional too soon. Keep it fun. Keep them engaged. So that's what I like to see.
Just on that, you know, you mentioned there about that. The one on dominance. And I'm seeing lately, you may have come across it yourself, where a lot of people going down the route now calling them specialists, themselves specialists in these areas. What are your thoughts and observations around that to start with?
I think one-to-one coaching is very difficult because, yes, you can teach them the technique, but to teach them the how and when and why in a 1v1, a one-to-one coaching, if it's me and you, I can't teach you that at that time because there's no decision to be made. I find that really difficult. So, yes, it's good for their technique. Yes, it's good for them to build confidence in doing a skill, doing a trick, whatever. But then that smaller group work, I love seeing some of the coaches. Like I say, I see a lot of coaching. I know a lot of academy boys will now go and do their own private stuff. But I much prefer seeing it when it's like 2, 3, 4 of them and they're just getting loads of goes, but there's a decision to be made and there's actually a real life scenario in front of them. And I think that's what's important, is going, well, how do you keep it looking real? And how, because most kids can do skills with no opposition and they can do them to a really high level, but being able to do it when you know there's pressure there and the kid isn't just going to let you run past him, or he's not going to let you do your little Maradona turn or your step over without trying to win it back or kick you, is a different skill altogether. So I think there's a place for it, but to say, that's probably, I don't want to go any further. I'll probably keep my mouth shut a little bit. Yeah, there's some good work being done, but I think there needs to be, I'd much prefer seeing the smaller group stuff.
Sure. So just to build on that then, obviously it's a bit murky waters there, aren't they? Because a lot of people are going to get, very offended in some ways, and very about this sort of thing. So what do you think it takes for someone to be able to classify them as a specialist, themselves as a specialist in that though? Because you see a lot, don't you, now where, this person, they've never worked in that quote-unquote elite environment, but they call themselves an elite football coach. Or they've never worked, they've never worked with high-level players, but now they call themselves a ball mastery specialist. Or, I don't know. There's, it's a hot debate right now.
It is a hot debate. I don't know. I suppose I work in an elite environment because it's an academy football. But does that make me an elite coach? I don't know. I wouldn't class myself as an elite coach. I would say that I'm a coach with good experiences. But I suppose elite is when you work at the top level. If I'm going to be an elite coach, I need to work in the Premier League.
Would you call yourself a foundation phase specialist?
Probably not yet, no. I think there are people that have done it longer than myself and have had probably more successes than myself. I would say I'm just a foundation, a good coach. maybe that's just me being humble of it, but I don't really know I don't know what classes you to be a specialist. Is it 10 years experience? Is it 20 years experience? Is it whatever? I don't know. To class yourself as it, I think I suppose I could sit here and go, yeah, I'm a academy specialist. But unless you see me work, you'd have your own opinions of it. So to class yourself, I don't think people should be classing themselves as it. And you should just say I'm a good one-to-one coach. I'm a one-to-one coach. That's it. Yeah. That's my.
Spot on. I think it's all well and good, identifying that you might have certain strengths or certain areas of interest or areas in which I don't really want to use the word, but areas that you specialize in.
Yeah, but
specialize in it doesn't make you a specialist.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's like I say, you go. There's coaches out there. You go, well, I don't know, I've got my son now, he's 3.5. If I wanted to get really good at skills, I wouldn't coach him because I haven't got skills. If I wanted to be good at passing it, 1v1 defending, all that kind of stuff, then yeah, that's something I can help him with. There are people, like you say, that are more specialised in that ball mastery, that trickery, that those other bit elements that aren't maybe my areas of expertise or specialism, because as an individual, I wasn't very good at skills. So why would I then class myself as a specialist of that? I agree with you. There are people that are specializing in different things. I suppose I don't know where the classification of IMA specialist comes in. I'm not too sure. But like I say, there are, with the one-to-one stuff, I think there is some really good work going out there. There is, but I think during that COVID period, everyone became a one-to-one coach, didn't they? Because that was a way to potentially make money or start businesses. You see the longevity now since COVID has moved on. You've seen the ones that are still around. You're going, well, yeah, you're doing well because people believe in what you're doing. You're making players better. And they're the ones that are the ones that you could go, yeah, he's starting to become a specialist in that area.
100%. Adam, just got one final question, really. But this is a hot topic. We kind of just touched on it briefly a few moments ago. Unopposed or opposed?
I think there's a place for both. I grew up in an era and started coaching in an era where block practices and drills were probably the way. And I still think there's a place for them. As long as you coach it properly and it has a realism to it, I think there's some really good stuff. I think if people did a passing drill, they'd go, that's old. That's old school. But it worked. It created players. So what stops it working now? Yes, if you don't add the finer details and you don't show the boys where it fits into the game, then, yeah, it's not going to work. because everyone can just pick up a session off YouTube or off the internet. There's so many coaching companies out there now, isn't there? Those coaching websites, you can pick up a session. Doesn't mean you can coach that session. You might be able to facilitate the start of it, but then how far you take it, that's you as the coach. How good are you as the coach? So I think there's a place for both. I think for boys learning new techniques and building confidence in being able to do the technique, then that's where your opposed stuff comes in. Yes, I can do it. But if you then go, right, well, you've got to do it straight away against an opponent. Well, if he just gets failure all the time and goes, well, I don't know, let's say it's your step over. If he doesn't know that his foot has to go from the outside to the inside and around it, like anti-clockwise, how's he going to pick that up before if he's getting tackled every time and doesn't get a chance to actually complete the skill? So I think there's a place for both. And I think the modern, learning takes you away from that. And I think it's probably perceived as a bit old school now. But I grew up in that old school era. I'm 35, but I probably have a lot more old school in me than new school.
100%, I fully agree with you. I think it does have its place. I think the question I just need to think about is really is it working at its best? So it just because it's working doesn't mean there is a better ways to be doing it. And just because there's better ways to do it doesn't mean it's more appropriate or less appropriate at any given time. So just really rationalizing why you're going to use it, when you're going to use it, for who you're going to use it for as well. Adam, going to take you back one last question to the start of your journey. If you could go back and speak to yourself back then, knowing what you know now, something that you'd want to say to yourself.
Oh, what would I say?
That one bit of advice.
What a great question that is. I suppose I would go back, and I didn't learn it till I left where I was at the start. Be authentic. I tried at the start when I was trying to be someone that wasn't me. I was trying to be some of my mentors, and coached. I was trying to be a copy of them. But it was only when I left that and I went, I'm not them. And there are other ways, and you work with other people and you go, well, I like a bit of them as well. So you obviously the people you work with, you take, like you do in any session, you nick bits. And I like the way he coaches, and I like the way he interacts with the players, and I like the way he's organized. And you take bits and bobs from everyone you work with and meet. And I think that would probably be, it probably took me the first 4 or 5 years of my coaching career to learn that and go, no, take bits from everybody and take the bits that you like and want to be, and be authentic to yourself. I think that would probably be the, and it might, I don't know, I might be still be in the same place. I might be 5 years ahead of myself. I don't know. Who knows? But that would probably be my bit of advice to myself, would be the version of me, not a version of somebody else.
Be your best self. 100%. I think it's a spot on, great message as well. Adam, just want to say massive thank you for your time today, man. Really appreciate it. And wish you all the best, man.
No, have a good Christmas. And yeah, we'll catch up in the new year.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at The Coaches Network or on Twitter at The Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.